Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bowne. Now on today's show, we've got one big dose of pop music that'll have you raring to get on the dance floor during the festive season. Down by the river here in London, the South Bank Centre has just unveiled its brand new show, ABBA Super Troopers. Created in conjunction with the ABBA Museum in Stockholm, it's an immersive show that takes you through the events that put the Swedish pop powerhouse on the map during the 1970s. It's called ABBA Super Troopers and producer Holly went down to see it and will take the reins from here on in.
Super trooper beams are gonna blind me, but I won't feel blue like I always do, 'cause somewhere in the crowd there's...
This year, the South Bank Centre has been celebrating Northern Europe in their festival Nordic Matters. This has seen the arts complex put on shows by authors, musicians and artists from the region, as well as installing a Finnish sauna for braver visitors. The latest part of the celebration is dedicated to the biggest purveyors of pop from Northern Europe, ABBA. Taking place in the ground floor space that just hosted a large Moomins exhibition, this immersive show takes you through the decade that ABBA thrived from the mid-70s to the early 80s. It begins with the titular item, the Super Trooper.
Welcome. Willkommen. This is your Super Trooper. A spotlight shining like the sun. It has illuminated many stages, held many superstars in its magic beam. You may have heard its name before. Perhaps on your radio many moons ago, when four people from Sweden started singing about it. Super-pa, troopa-pa. And took it to the top of the charts. A place they'd been many times before. Shining like the sun, feeling like a number one.
The show then takes you on a journey through nine rooms. A Eurovision hotel room in Brighton, a caravan dressing room in Sydney, through wardrobe doors that lead not to Narnia but to a Swedish folk concert in a forest. It's a take on the band's success that puts them into a British context while taking you on an unpredictable trip through locations, lyrics and lycra. But it also celebrates a brilliant pop group, who embraced and transcended the cheesiness of Eurovision to become wonderful songwriters and worldwide superstars.
You'll see why in a minute. The song is called... Oh, and it's Napoleon! Napoleon, no wonder the song is called Waterloo. This is Sven Olaf Waldorf, who's really entered into the spirit of it all, dressed as Napoleon, waiting for Waterloo by ABBA for Sweden. Watch this one.
The exhibition explores their relationships. You'll find notebooks with Agneta and Bjorn's names drawn around love hearts, the band's quest for studio perfection in a replica room to the one they recorded in, and the rise and unravelling of one of the greatest pop bands of all time. ABBA Super Troopers is put on in conjunction with the ABBA Museum in Stockholm. The morning of the launch, an excited audience is lucky enough to be addressed by Bjorn from the band.
Yes, because we thought it was a very interesting angle, very interesting idea behind it, to kind of link our songs to contemporary history here in Britain.
I meet the show's curator, Paul Denton, and the director of the ABBA Museum and a former makeup artist to the band, Ing-Marie Helling.
I'm Paul Denton. I'm producer here at the South Bank Centre and curator of ABBA Super Troopers, the exhibition. We're doing something quite new here at South Bank Centre. We're doing immersive exhibitions. So immersive is often used a lot to describe things and what actually is it. But we create a series of rooms where they're like theatrical sets, and we use original archive material and we embed them in that set and have a narration score and a soundscape. So you kind of do feel fully immersed in the rooms you're in and see the work in a different way. So we knew from previous exhibitions that's the way we wanted to present ABBA. The angle we took in terms of how we were looking at them, we thought it was interesting. If you look at the charts throughout the sort of 8 years they were at the peak of their career, musical tastes were changing in the UK and political tastes were changing in the UK. ABBA stayed at the top and were always top of the charts, within at least top five, you know, continually. So what was it about them that connected to people's hearts and minds? And so we tried to investigate that and look at that. 1973 and 74 had parallels with today as well. We were just joining the EEC back in 1973, just now, as we're just leaving it. We had a hung parliament, the economy was kind of failing. So ABBA's music is kind of was like a tonic for the times, that kind of the joyous nature of their music cut through a lot of that kind of sadness in the time. And I think that's what people really enjoyed and still do about ABBA's music.
Come into my house. It's Britain, the early 1970s. The British economy is failing. Rail workers are striking. There's violence on the streets. And a vote on whether to join Europe has divided the country. Parliament is just barely hanging together. Can you imagine living in a country like that?
And in the talk before we launched the exhibition this morning, we were talking about how, you know, ABBA's obviously a Swedish band, but they are very much been adopted by the Brits, and the Brits like to think of them as a British band. Did you want to put them into a British context in this exhibition?
I think it's important of how the UK audiences did take ABBA into their hearts. After Waterloo, I mean, Waterloo was the pivotal moment. Obviously, it was in Brighton, in the Brighton Dome, and so obviously we felt an affiliation with them at that very moment. Their actually popularity did wane after Waterloo. So there was a couple of years when actually they didn't have many big hits in the UK. And it was through their music videos that got sent around the world, especially to Australia. So we were directed by Lasse Hallström. And he directed the first four videos and created that iconic kind of ABBA double-faced look that we all know today. And it was then the popularity in Australia which then kind of made the world stand up and listen to them again. So I think Britain's had a great love affair with ABBA, and I think it continues to this day. And it's great to chart that different history. Some of the spaces we have in the exhibition are a dingy 70s nightclub toilet. And it's about how people connected with ABBA in different ways. And one of the ways was they were able to dance with them in clubs. And their music allows even the most non-dance-friendly people to just get up and start moving. And there's some joy in ABBA's music, while at the same time having quite a stoic, melancholy nature to their lyrics. There's something quite unique about it.
My name is Ing-Marie Halling, and I work as a creative director and curator at ABBA the Museum in Stockholm, Sweden. I met them first time in 75 because my boyfriend was playing guitar with them. So I met them 75, but I started working with them 77. I think I feel the same way as I know that Björn does, that he doesn't have that nostalgia feeling anymore because he can look back on it very... with a very clear view, and more like it happened to someone else for so many years ago. So I can relate to that. I can look back on it and I was another person and than I am today, but I thoroughly love that time with them. It was one of the best jobs I've had in my life.
We're now here at the South Bank Centre where Super Troopers has just launched. How does the exhibition here differ from what you do at the ABBA Museum in Stockholm?
It's so difficult to describe this because this is a unique exhibition. It doesn't look like anything else that you have seen before. I mean, I've seen Moomins that they had here, and that's the same layup as they have now for this. It differs in many ways, but in many ways not, if you see what I mean, because we have a big house in Stockholm. We can tell the story in another way, and the people that comes to the museum, they want the whole works. They want to know what happened from day one to the last day. Here they have picked out certain points in time and work with them very thorough. So it's more highlighting special items and special times, and I also know that when Paul came to the archive in Stockholm, he was actually looking for this little, you know, scrappy papers and little notes and things like that that we don't have in the museum in the same way. We also have a lot of interactive things in the museum in Stockholm, which they obviously can't have here because it's quite a narrow space. But they've done a tremendous job with this exhibition, really.
I had to learn a lot about ABBA. Obviously, I knew ABBA, and it's amazing, actually, when you listen to their music, how many songs you automatically know. You know all the lyrics, you know the rhythm, how the beat works. But actually, facts about ABBA, you realise there's Uber fans out there that know 10 times more than you do. And so we've been careful to find those fans and work with them. I mean, we work closely with Inge-Marie Halling, which has been wonderful, and we've got beautiful insights and anecdotes. She was their makeup artist on tour, and she knows all that kind of backstage moments. She's also great friends with them, so could census check a lot of what we were saying and what we were trying to say, which was really wonderful. But we've put a call out for archive. It wasn't just from the ABBA Museum. We found great fans that had beautiful pieces in their lofts, in their homes, that have loaned for this exhibition, which is really great. And it's taking those kind of personal moments and personal natures of the work, which really makes this exhibition work.
So it's kind of like a real love affair with the band, really.
Yeah, I mean, one of the pieces we've got is by a lady from Brighton. It's a score sheet that was given out in the Argus newspaper on the night of the win. And you could sit at home and score your favourite Eurovision band. And in it, she scored Sweden number one and starred it. And then she went down to Brighton and got everyone to sign it. So this is huge record of actually someone sitting at home and that connection with the band and then actually meeting them in person. That kind of is something really special in that.
And tell us about these nine rooms that you go through in the exhibition.
So it's a series of nine rooms, and we try to make it unexpected turns as you move along each room. So you may move out through a wardrobe or through a caravan. What we try to do is kind of chart their history from a UK perspective. So the first room you walk in is a 1970s living room. And we move through to different spaces, which include their Polar Music Studio, which was the studio they created and which created their unique sound. You may move through, as I mentioned earlier, nightclub toilets. And also we may recreate some certain images or videos from their career, such as the One of Us video.
And you went to the ABBA Museum in Sweden to take some of the things they have in their archives. Were there any specific things you were looking for, or what was your favourite thing that you took from there?
I think what we were clear about, there was some, obviously ABBA Museum does it extremely well, and so we didn't want to just replicate what they did. So we worked closely with Inge-Marie to go through their archive, their stores, and find kind of the things that maybe they didn't want to put on display. And these included small little handwritten notes and doodles from Frida before they were ABBA, which for us were more important because they tell a distinct story and a personal narrative story. Some key favourites of mine are the gold cape that we've got. So these iconic gold capes that were designed by Uwe Sandström, who was their designer of all their clothes on stage. Gold cape's beautiful in its own right, but this is a water-stained gold cape. It's got marks all over it, and it tells the story of when she was on stage in the Sydney concert in 77 and Frida tripped on stage. And so it's his waterlogged cape. So from that moment, not only is it a beautiful object in its own right, but it tells a beautiful story to go along with it. And I think it's those kind of things which really help bring the exhibition to life.
And did you learn anything surprising about the band when you were doing this?
I think everyone thinks of them maybe as not pop fluff, but I think they don't realise the importance of the band. They weren't a manufactured band. They were great musicians. And what we wanted to try and do was get across how well crafted their music was. They spent a lot of time in the studio, and their music is multi-layered. If you look at Dancing Queen, one of their most, you know, famous and loved tracks, it's multi-layered, beautifully produced. The way their voices are stretched, Agnetha had a high range, Frida a low range, and that kind of wall of sound that they put together is quite unique for them. So I just think, actually, if we can demonstrate just actually how important they were in terms of their music, then I think that's a good job.
One of the strengths of the exhibition is its narration, which is read by Jarvis Cocker, an ideal choice for a band held in such high regard and as a fellow wordsmith. The script he reads is written by the music journalist Jude Rogers. We discuss her own relationship with ABBA and how she wrote for one of the UK's most famous voices.
This year, the Eurovision Song Contest has been held in Britain, in the magnificent Brighton Dome, a nearby seaside palace full of chandeliers and glamour. A fitting location for the victorious band. It was built only a decade before Napoleon's last stand, and tonight has been the scene of another battle. At the beginning of the evening, the Brits wanted their warrior to prevail, a young woman called Olivia Newton-John, with her battle cry, "Long live love." Then, a different, colourful cavalry took to the field.
First of all, I didn't know who's going to be the narrator. There was somebody else in line for it as well, but Jarvis was the person that was really wanted. You know, he's such a good choice for the exhibition. You know, he is somebody who is a big pop figure, but obviously lives very much in the realm of alternative music as well. He spans so many different areas of music. So having him, as soon as I knew it was him who was the narrator, that was just an absolute joy, obviously, because Jarvis has a certain persona, which is funny and slightly sleazy and cheeky. Obviously, I had to tone that down slightly for a more mainstream audience. But, you know, he has a lot of affection and love and romance for pop music, but he also has a very acute sense of irony and humour. And just, that was what I always wanted to get across with any presenter for the script, to be honest, was that this is a band that are very much loved, even though for many years, you know, they were, you know, laughed at in some respects, you know, because they were this huge pop band from Sweden and they had slightly strange accents, they wore funny clothes and, you know, they weren't as cool as the, you know, biggest purveyors of disco or glam rock or whoever it might be. They sat slightly outside that in terms of coolness. But I wanted to get that affection and that irony through, but not make it ironic in any way that didn't show how important I thought that they were as a band. If you listen to any of their songs for more than, you know, a couple of listens in the background, you'll hear the incredible amount of artistry that goes into their music. You know, the harmonic writing, the melodic writing, the women's voices are extraordinary together, and the lyrics are very direct, very bold, very dark sometimes, even in some of their biggest hits. You know, there's a lot going on there. So yeah, Jarvis was absolutely perfect to get those different ideas across.
Yeah, I would say that they're complete masters of songwriting and probably some of the best breakup songs ever written as well. Is it quite daunting trying to do such big stars justice in this exhibition format?
Oh, it was very daunting. It was very daunting. When I started writing, the thing that I went to first really was the lyrics. And I use a lot of the lyrics within the exhibition script itself because they say so much, you know, about the band and where they were at specific times. I use some well-known lyrics, but I also use some lesser-known lyrics because I wanted to get something in the exhibition for, you know, the kind of regular mainstream fan who might just be a huge fan of Mamma Mia, the musical, for example. But I also wanted the nerds to think, oh, that's a line from that album track from Arrival or whatever it may be. So the lyrics really helped. And they were my way in writing the script in many respects. So by using their words and going straight to them and building the script around that, you know, that kind of helped it be a little less daunting because I was working with the best material I could possibly work with.
And you're predominantly a print writer. I know you've done other radio stuff as well, though. But how do you find the transition of writing for the page to writing for the voice and also not your own voice?
Yeah, that was quite new for me in some respects. I have done radio writing the last 2 or 3 years, and I made a couple of documentaries for Radio 4 for which I've had to write scripts for myself. Obviously, you know, that is responding to, you know, my voice and my style. You know, it helps that I've been a Pulp fan for many years and listened to Jarvis Cocker on the radio, and I know what his style is. But as I say, you know, his usual style on his shows is a little more misty, sleazy, and I wanted to have it a little more romantic, respectful, funny for this. I really enjoyed it. I really love writing for The Voice. You know, I've always been the kind of print writer that really thinks about the rhythms of the language and how a sentence sounds. So this is something that I'm hoping to move into more, really, because I do really enjoy it. As I say, just imagining Jarvis reading out certain ABBA lyrics or certain lines of the script was so much fun, and especially in particular rooms. There's a 1970s living room very early on, which is decked out in, you know, terrible wallpaper, and there's a television playing some of the terrible news at the time. You know, this is the time when politics was in disarray. There was a vote on whether to join Europe or not, which I very much enjoyed putting in a joke about, but the comparisons then and now. But, you know, anybody who's a Pulp fan or a Jarvis fan could imagine the young Jarvis growing up in that kind of place, because it's very much the style that he's always had and very much had, you know, the heights of Pulp in the 90s with his 70s shirts and, you know, songs about wood chip on the wall. There were so many different layers to play with. It was just a really rich kind of combination of things to work with, really.
Yeah, and I guess that room that highlights all these links between politics in the 70s and now is talking about ABBA as escapism. You know, people want to listen to pop music to escape all the terrible things that are happening on TV. Do you think that part of ABBA's success was due to the time that they were releasing this music?
I think ABBA would have been successful at any point, really. Now, what ABBA were really good at was soaking up the influences of the time and turning them into something that was completely their own sound. You know, when they started out, they were doing sort of glam rock sounding songs. You know, later on, they played with, you know, reggae, not as successfully, but they played with disco, obviously, and did that very well. But it was such a difficult time in many respects back then, you know, politically, economically. But it was also a time, you know, this is like the early 70s, after the big rush of creativity at the in the 60s and late 60s, and things were getting a bit more psychedelic and then progressive, and then a lot of music was getting quite bloated. And then suddenly there was this return to the basics of rock and roll through glam rock, you know, but with a new twist of colour and, you know, kind of playing with gender and all these different things. I know ABBA didn't necessarily do that like Bowie or Bolan did, but they took the directness of those songs and kind of really made them particularly exciting. Maybe because they were two very, you know, obviously lovely, sweet couples, you know, helped the image and helped their popularity, you know, in some respects. But without those songs and without those voices coming together and the, you know, the musicianship, you know, you listen to an ABBA record, there are so many layers going on, which, you know, indeed you find out about in the music studio room of the exhibition. I think maybe, yeah, being successful at the time is, you know, the times did help them become successful, but I generally think they would have been successful at any point. You know, you can only look at the ways bands have covered their songs in years later. You know, those would have been hits without them being ABBA covers, you know, when Erasure covered them or Steps or whoever it may be. You know, those songs prevail beyond their times, really.
Yeah, and there's that lovely bit at the end of the exhibition where you're sitting in a fake aeroplane and you're watching videos of all the different people who've covered their songs. And I guess it kind of made me think, like, you know, ABBA is one of those bands that gets introduced to every new generation. I suppose my generation got to know ABBA through the Steps and Bewitched super band that did like a big mega mix.
Take a chance, take a chance, take a chicka chance, chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chicka chance, chance, take a chance, take a chance,
take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a
chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a chance, take a any other band who has really had that?
No, not really. You know, I got into them firstly because Erasure did an EP called the ABBA-esque EP, and they dressed up as, you know, as Agnetha and Frida. That was my first introduction to them. But I really got back into them again when there's this Norwegian singer called Susanna, who plays with Susanna in a Magical Orchestra, did this really stripped back, dark, sad version of Lay All Your Love on Me. And that is when it made me think, oh gosh, I mean, you know, I'd always loved ABBA, I had always loved them, but it made me think about them again.
Lay all your love on me.
My first memory, I was nearly three, and my first memory, I was hearing Super Trooper on the radio, and it was number one. But as I've grown older, you know, their lyrics reveal themselves in different ways. You realise how many different people can cover them and how rich those songs are, how they connect in so many different ways. I think it'll just carry on. You know, I'm not a particular fan of the film of Mamma Mia, to be honest, but, you know, that connected people. I know why it connected with people, because it took the songs in a very different way. You know, there's all these different ways in which you can present their songs. And actually their music itself is, you know, it ranges so much. You know, you listen to something like Chiquitita, which is fantastic, but then you also listen to, you know, The Name of the Game, or some, you know, listen to The Whole of the Visitors, which is desperately bleak. You know, there's so much within them. They're not just, you know, four shiny-toothed, you know, Swedes who you know, just fallen into Eurovision, which, you know, hopefully they finally escaped that idea of themselves now.
So I thank ABBA for the music, for giving it to me. Super.
dreams are gonna blind me, but I won't feel blue like I always do, 'cause somewhere in the crowd there's
ABBA Super Troopers is on at the South Bank Centre until the 28th of April 2018, and you can find out more information and book tickets at southbankcentre.co.uk. And that brings us to the end of Culture. This show is produced and made entirely, in fact, by Holly Fisher, of course. We'll be back at the same time next week when we'll be reliving the best bits of our Something Old, Something New series from this year. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bounds, and thank you very much for tuning in.